Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You are going to hear from Steve and Andrew. They're going to cover some Marvel Super Specials. Before that, I will briefly talk about the bunches of Captain America issues I read, ending with 22, most recent issue. Apparently, for some strange reason, a controversial issue, which baffles me because I didn't see anything alarming in the issue aside from the story that's going on, but how any of the characters are acting, that's just, I don't know. I read The Iron Nail, I read 16 Point Now, which was pretty much a Jet Black issue, which was pretty damn good. The Nick Klein art was fantastic. It was, I haven't really seen his work since, Viking. I think that's what the book was. But this was just, this was fantastic. It actually, it was kind of a neat meld between, the Romita and Jansen stuff and the Pacheco, and initially Jansen, and now the Mariano inks. But the Klein stuff was gorgeous. I thought it was a... I'm digging the story. It's you know, I mean, if you... It reminds me of the old Captain America issues that Grunwald or DeMatteis wrote. It is Brett DeLeo 180 from the Brubaker espionage stuff, and it's great. Touches on some Winter Soldier stuff. We have some S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. I like how Maria Hill is kind of growing her hair long, kind of just like the movie version. But yeah, I thought that I really, really am enjoying Captain America, and I would really recommend it. There are a couple of trades out now, so I don't think it's. He really is taking that whole man out of time twice now, but he really is a man out of time. And he, it's interesting how between a Captain America and what how he was written by Robinson in All New Invaders, Captain America is not really on the ball these days. There are he doesn't. He kind of sees the whole picture, but he's missing some pieces, and getting from point A to B to C, there may be a misstep, and he's missing something here and there. So, I like how he's not the perfect specimen. And so that being said, I would recommend All New Invaders as well. It's, I finished the first arc. I have the Original Sins, issues to read next. I'm probably going to read those after I finish the recent Original Sin. I think number 5 is out. So I have that tapped to read next. We touched on some of the Original Sin stuff on 11 o'clock comics, but I have that to read. I am current on Moon Knight. Still loving the hell out of that book. And of course, Iron Fist, the Living Weapon, continues to just blow me away. And the way Andrews tells this kind of flashback story in the fourth issue. Flashbacks are great, and they can work really well. But I was moving along with this story, and now we're back to the evening of the first issue and the events following dinner with Danny and Brenda or Debbie or Maria, and their conversation and how they acted with each other, and then we get to basically where the towards the middle or end of the first it's been well done. The art is great, but Andrews is really knocking it out of the park with me with the writing. I'm loving the tale he's weaving here. I really I finished the issue, and I need the next one right away. Kudos to him for that. While we're on the martial arts tip, I read the second issue of Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, where Shang-Chi is going on this mission, and he needs to solve it, and this mystery. And there are eyes in the sky, and there's an awesome appearance by Nightwing, or, well, Colleen Wing and Misty Knight. And again, you know, even I'm just really, really enjoying everything that I've been reading lately. There really hasn't been anything where I'm like, okay, I can hold off on that for a while. And The Punisher, another one that reminded me, these past two issues, 7 and 8, reminded me of back in the day when Mike Baron was writing it. And you had, or even Chuck Dixon, where you would have the main ongoing story, and then instead of you getting a fill-in artist covering like part two or three of a five-part story, you would have a different artist kind of just do a side mission. So whereas we had Mitch Gerrits draw the first six issues, and taking on the Del Sols and the Del Solos and the Howling Commandos show up, these two issues followed that immediately, but it was Frank down in Mexico, dealing with another situation, which I guess will lead into issue 9, but the characters introduced in this two-parter were kind of their own thing, and I just thought that it not just moved the story along, moved the overall story along, but it was it felt like it was part of everything. It just visually looked a little different, but it still fit. It's not like it was, you know, oh, by the way, 3 months ago this happened, and then we're going to stop the main story, you know, to screech it to a halt, and then pick up in a couple of months when the main team comes back. It worked, and I everything I'm talking about, I definitely would recommend to anyone. So I'm done rambling. I'm going to let Steve and Andrew do their bit. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Hope everybody had a great 4th of July. Hope everybody is staying cool, or they are if they can. And that is pretty much it. So take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, moviegoers. Already sunburned Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Andrew the L.A. Rabbit, who, well, let's face it, is the heart and soul of Marvel Noise.
Well, I don't know about that, Steve. I would say you're the heart, soul, and engine of Marvel Noise, with the king being the cherry on top of the sundae.
Well, we've gathered here in the middle of the summer to talk about kind of a summery topic that we've had floating around as a potential topic for Marvel Noise for, well, honestly, years now, because old friend of the show and former contributor Adam Bessignotti and I were once going to talk about this topic, and schedules got crazy, and Dave Kay even made up a faux poster picture for it and everything, and here we are years later getting to the topic of Marvel's summer blockbuster adaptations.
You could even argue this has been boiling in the pipeline for almost 30 years.
That's right. For those who are thinking we're about to talk about Marvel's movies this summer, Marvel might be in the summer blockbuster market now, but back during the licensing frenzy time of like the mid-70s to the mid-80s, Marvel was in the summer blockbuster business in an entirely different way with adaptations of movies.
Yeah, well, I know we've both been enjoying the slew of recent history books, and pretty much everyone I've read about Marvel mentions how that original Star Wars license really provided a necessary cash infusion for the company who had ridden that first wave of the 60s but had a bit of a downturn in the 70s, and then they get the Marvel Star Wars licensed comics, which I know I had as a kid, and those were such a phenomenal success that it really provided an extra boost. So in a sense, now they may not be considered as prestigious or as important, but these movie adaptations meant a lot to Marvel.
And with how they published them basically was as a Marvel magazine, but full color, not like the other Marvel magazines that were black and white with a color cover.
And some of these also did come out in floppy form too, so you could get them, but there it would be like two or three issues or four, whatever it was, where the magazines were nice because it was all one thing, you know, you didn't have to get each issue.
Right. Well, this was Marvel Super Special, and it was 41 issues of Marvel Magazine in full color from 77 to 86. And then, as you said, they would come out afterwards as a limited series, often in comic book form.
Because certainly in my youth, this would have been the era. I mean, maybe by the end, 86 might have been my first comic shop, but I was buying these things off the rack. But the nice thing about the magazine stuff is those would actually be sold at, like, sort of newsagent-type places.
Yeah. There
was one, so...
Like in the airport, you know?
In my little hick town, they did have little corner shops that would have, like, sodas and stuff. Kind of sort of generic 7-Elevens, but the magazines were a much bigger part of sales back then. The kids of today, I don't think... I mean, these places have magazine racks, but maybe they got 15 magazines on them or something. But back then, you know, you'd have 200 magazines to choose from.
And this is even back, not only before the internet, but back before home video was even, you know, prolific in every home. At that time, the only way that we could relive movies, Andrew, was like through trading cards. If there was trading cards from the movie, if you went to see the movie again, you know, but they would only be out for a limited time. And back then, movies didn't keep coming back to the theaters. You could get like a souvenir magazine that would be like full of pictures and kind of on the expensive side, you know, usually from like the makers of Starlog or something like that, you know. And then you could get the comics adaptation, which was mostly for Marvel. I mean, occasionally if it was a DC property, the DC would do their adaptation of it. Heavy Metal did the adaptation for Alien, you know, the original Ridley Scott movie. But mostly it was Marvel who was counted on for your ability to revisit your movie over and over again at your own pace.
And I will throw one other source that I haven't read in forever, but I used to read the novelizations.
Sure.
Because they would frequently put stills in the movie.
Yeah, the little
color
section.
It would
section.
Be a paperback, but there would be like six color stills in the middle.
Right.
And so that was always a popular way to experience your media. But as we get to some of these, I'm going to say I remember reading the comic way before I ever saw the movie, because some of them I just missed. Our little town had like a two-screen theater, and we didn't, and a couple of drive-ins, and we didn't always go to the movies. So for some of these, I didn't see the movie till years after, when it would be out on HBO or VHS or something like that. So the comic was my only exposure.
And not just that, but the novelizations definitely, and often the super special comics adaptation would come out actually before the movie did. So it was your way of, you know, getting to see what the movie was going to be about in some cases, but then also, you know, that led to a lot of opportunities for big inconsistencies.
Yes.
Between what ended up on the cutting room floor and on the screen and what ended up in the adaptation, you know?
Star Wars is a great example of some of those old comics having slightly different than the movie ended up being, but it didn't matter. I mean, I think to sort of drive home the point, there was such a paucity of source material that we all just kind of made it up in our heads. And I wouldn't be surprised if we got lines wrong, or, you know, your memories end up surpassing the original content of how you take in this media. So now where, you know, you could instantly double check any quotation. You know, if I want to quote something, I just jump on Bing, Google, Ask Jeeves, whatever, and I'll have the actual quote. But back then, you might misremember it or something like that. Because there's another part in here where I had slightly misremembered a quote. I mean, I got the gist of it, but I didn't have the full thing in. But that's how you remembered it.
And the other delivery system for a couple of Marvel movie adaptations also was the Marvel Treasury Edition. The big, big oversized tabloid size. I know they did the first Star Wars movie that way. And, you know, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yes. But, and I had the Star Wars one, obviously.
Me too.
Being a little Star Wars nut, it was like a must. Aside from the comics, you also had to have. Those treasuries were so have such an indelible place in my mind. But part of my love for the artist edition, in some ways, is reminiscent of the oversized nature of those books.
Sure.
As the relative proportions, I feel, are almost the same.
Well, Marvel Super Special Color Magazine didn't start out initially as a adaptation movie vehicle, but rather in 1977 it was to adapt the property of the rock band Kiss in its first issue, written by Steve Gerber and consultation by Michael Gross from the Kiss side of things, and art by Alan Weiss, John and Sal Buscema, Rich Buckler, and Al Milgram.
And this finally answers the question of why Kiss never tours Latveria.
They have to face off against Dr. Doom. There's a great wraparound Alan Weiss painted cover also with Dr. Doom on the back. That's a really fantastic image.
I got to say, except for a few examples, you may have a different notice, but I think of what it is in different times. But this is a time when they really put top people on the art duties. Like, most of these look pretty sharp.
Yeah.
Now their fidelity to the source material varies greatly depending on who's on it, but you're going to see some really good stuff.
And, you know, they were really tickled to be doing this thing with Kiss and trying to, you know, get exposure into Kiss's market. They had like a 2-page making of the issue with the staff photo of them all happy with Kiss. And this was the one where they did the stunt of getting their blood drawn and mixed with the printing ink the members of the band did. So they have a feature on that showing them all getting their blood drawn in makeup to be printed into the comic book as servicing their fans like no other band has.
The sad thing is, though, after you've looked at that great art of them, then to see their actual photos of them, they look so, like, puny and boring.
There were cameos by Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, Avengers, and the Defenders, too, which is pretty cool.
There was also an ad for Air Latveria.
I love that. You really haven't lived till you've spent an evening or two in a Latverian bistro, sipping aphrodisiac potions and tapping your toe to the blues improvisations of the Black Forest Five.
And as Steve mentioned earlier, there's plenty of kind of back matter, which would be, I don't know if these magazines still exist, but there was a plethora in my youth of just magazines that would crank out kind of puff pieces and be like basically Tiger Beat for all intents and purposes, but just of different genres.
Sure.
So while Kiss may not make Tiger Beat, this had the same sort of
cream
journalistic rigor that had of just like, aren't these guys great? And, you know, they do give the history and everything, but they're not going to be in any way anything other than a flattering portrayal.
And I'll have to post on Twitter and Tumblr, there's an interesting one-page text piece that precedes the entire storyline that's a history of Dr. Doom.
Yeah, I think now they would probably avoid it, because I know Kevin would shriek and scream that they put a date on Doc's birth. And I know he's the party that you never put dates on anything, because it ends up trapping you in. You know, you're forever locked at that time. I don't have a problem with it, but I know he would. But you forgot to mention, and along with Dr. Doom, we have Mephisto.
Yeah.
In here. But Mephisto, you know, he's the regular Mephisto. Right from the Marvel U. Like, no different version or anything.
Drawn by John Buscema. Why should he look any different?
Yeah. I didn't know if they would try and kind of make him look a little different, but they don't. And the like I said, I really like how they portray the band and the makeup. It's much more dynamic and interesting than actual photos of the band.
So much so they did a good job, they do it again in a few issues. The second issue was The Savage Sword of Conan. What? Didn't we already have a Savage Sword of Conan magazine? But not in color, Andrew.
Yeah, and it's done with kind of a lighter coloring technique than the comics of the day would have been. It's really more restrained.
Yeah.
Almost like a colored pencil type of effect.
Marie Severin did the colors. It's Roy Thomas, John Buscema, and Alfredo Alcala, your Savage Sword of Conan team, almost supreme, I would say, under an Earl Norum cover. And this was a story of Conan kind of having an uneasy conflict and alliance with a Zingarian buccaneer. Good one.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. And the color, I mean, you always think of Savage Sword in black and white, but here the color, it's so subtle. I don't know that it added a lot, except there are certain kind of dream sequences where it really worked.
Yeah.
But in no way did it detract from it at all, which you can't always say when they put color on what you think of things for black and white.
They're still trying to figure it out for sure.
But I really like this is just a solid, typical Conan being Conan, where he's living by his code and most of the people around him aren't. But by sheer force of will, he's able to still overcome, even though they're not. And then they throw in some nice Robert E. Howard bits. And again, they feature the people involved.
Yeah.
And it's always fun to see photos of, you know, Marie Severin and Big John. And I don't think I'd ever seen a picture of Mr. Alcala either.
Myself neither. And yeah, one page profiles in depth, too. And Rascally Roy. Among them as well.
Although it says he's residing in upstate New York. Steve, you don't run into... I wonder if he's still there. So this was 30 years ago.
Yeah, that was... There was a pretty good... well, there still is, but it's mostly who's lingering from the days of old. But there was that whole Starlin, Wrightson, you know, Sinnott, that whole upstate New York gang. Issue number 3 was Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a movie adaptation with a Bob Larkin cover. And written by Archie Goodwin, with art by Walter Simonson and Klaus Janson.
And this is one where I think, you know, I really am a fan. That's an art team I like, but it's strange that I think this is one where they might have strayed from the likenesses quite a bit.
And they were directed to. Archie writes a one-page editorial explaining what a hot mess the whole project is. And... And he's saying they weren't allowed to, like, show what the aliens looked like. They weren't allowed to do likenesses, as with a lot of these projects, it says that they weren't allowed to do the likenesses. And very strange. And he basically apologizes in a explanation editorial.
But it still looks, I mean, I think it looks totally fine. To be fair, I don't know that I've seen this entire movie from beginning to end anyways. Aww. I've seen all, like, the famous clips and everything, but it just never, I think when it came out, I was in a Star Wars headspace, and this is not the sort of thing that you would feed a Star Wars person.
No.
This is something that is requires a level of maturity that I didn't have at that time. But, like I said, despite the not likeness thing, I think it's a pretty book and tight and... You know, it's Close Encounters. And I like that they tell you what the three kinds are, too.
Yeah, well, yeah. Very cool.
Because I didn't know that. You know, I'm not a Close Encounters guy.
That was the coolest thing. When they came out with the director's cut of the movie, like, another year or two later, and it was, like, had the parts that weren't, you know, it was, like, well, it was the director's cut. Everyone knows what one of those are now, but then everything made a lot more sense then. But yeah.
And so were you went and saw the movie in the theater?
Multiple times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't go to the movies a ton, so...
I was like 8 or 9 years old when that movie came out, so...
I rarely... You know, some of these I got to see, and some of them I didn't, but the next one is also not really a movie.
They were in some movies, I mean, though.
They mentioned movies.
Issue number 4 was The Beatles.
And this one, they make it look like, you know, you're not going to not recognize... The Beatles.
That's true. This is a wraparound painted Tom Palmer cover and written by David Anthony Kraft with art by George Perez and Klaus Janson.
Yeah, and I think it's sharp looking stuff. Perez really, for a guy that you think of with such otherworldly, like I always think of him for Avengers and Teen Titans and everything, This is a very, you know, nobody's in strange outfits or anything. Well, I guess the Beatles, but mostly they wear suits.
Yeah, strange haircuts. There's a lot jammed packed in here, too. It's a real Beatles souvenir magazine. The story is a history of the Beatles from inception to their split up. But there's an in-depth discography, a filmography. There's like a pull-out poster. A lot of stuff in here.
Yeah, this. If you were a Beatles person, I'm sure. Well, I don't know. You probably knew all this stuff. I don't know if you're a fan nowadays, but back then this would have been fine. I was not a big Beatles fan as a kid. I got plenty of them on classic radio, so I never sought out their albums or anything. But, you know, I don't. As I got older, I certainly had seen the Yellow Submarine in different states. So, you know, it's got its charms to it, but.
From the White Album on, baby.
I don't know that I ever. I guess I never fell under their spell. But it ends, of course, with the rooftop.
The fifth issue of Marvel Super Special is at the end of 1978 is a revisitation of Kiss with a Bob Larkin cover this time. And now it's written by Ralph Macchio with art by John Romita Jr. and Tony DeZuniga. And they have to face off against a Dark Lord sorcerer Ming the Merciless type.
Ugh, calling this guy a Ming the Merciless knockoff is an insult to not. I mean, they did nothing to differentiate this guy, except, I guess, give him a chest tattoo about halfway through, but he looks deadly-like. But they pull up the continuity is the same because they have a mentor from the first one that appears again. So we're right in the same. But like I said, I think the art is maybe even more fidelity to their likenesses. I mean, this is right on, and they have a great psychedelic two-page spread in the middle.
And a four-panel fold-out poster, too, which is pretty sweet.
These stories are just... the Kiss thing also eluded me. Like, I knew people that were into it, and it's fun. Like, I don't have strong feelings either way, so I think some of the magic of it is lost on me a bit. Steve, were you a Kiss guy?
I think I was Gene Simmons that year for Halloween.
Okay. So this is right in your wheelhouse. Yeah,
he had cool
the
makeup.
The aesthetic of kind of the absurd. I don't know. It's a weird mix between serious and absurd.
That yep.
If you're not a fan, I think I have a hard time figuring out where they put that line in.
He had gargoyles on his shoes.
Oh, the platform boots. I like.
I want
to. But anyways, going on to a Marvel magazine, Marvel Super Special, in full color, Jaws 2.
Number 6, that's right, great Bob Larkin cover, and the writer is only referred to as the writer. There's no credits other than in the making of feature where they talk about who worked on the book and how they worked on the book. But the writer is only referred to as, again, the writer, and I don't think it was Alan Moore, the original writer. There's a really interesting three-page interview with the director, too, where he explains that he was, like, thrown on the movie at the last second. And he's like, we're not trying to make War and Peace here. We're, like, making Jaws 2, you know, and it should be this and it should be that. And he was very frank in the interview, and I found it pretty refreshing as I dove into the material and relived the movie, another one that I'd seen in the movie several times. But the art is Gene Colan and Tom Palmer painted.
I think he does, and the, you know, the Brody, I think you would get, I mean, it's not as Schneidery as we're going to see later on, but it's pretty, I would recognize it as him. The other thing I liked, I don't remember seeing this one in the theater, this must have been an HBO one, but they really play up the action, too. Like, the shark is out of the water, like, on at least 5 or 6 different panels where they do these ones where he's totally out,
like,
you know, twisted. Yeah. So it looks kind of, you know, like that's what a comic book can give you, where the effects, especially at this time, may have been more limited. Here you can really have as crazy a demonstration of the shark doing it as you want. And at the end, to spoil it, the shark is done in by chomping on these giant lines. And it's like a half page with, like, all the zap and everything. And I'm like, this is where I think a comic can show its strength.
Yeah. I thought this was a great adaptation. Really nicely done. Colan and Palmer. The colors I thought were good even on it. you know, even sequel-wise, the Jaws sequels got crazy, but the second one wasn't really that bad. It's the one where all the kids were out there on their sailboats, and they all got stuck together, and then the shark was picking them off. Did have that ridiculous scene with the helicopter landing and the shark pulling the helicopter down. But, yeah, I thought it was cool. It was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like a solid... I don't remember the movie, to be honest, so... I guess it didn't stay with me that much.
The last scene is even cooler in the movie, Andrew, because he's hanging on the line and he's hitting it with a paddle. And by hitting it, he's making the, you know, the sonic reverberations that would draw the shark. And then he's got to dive off of there as the shark comes to try to get to him who's making the sound. And he leaves him with the mouth full of wire, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, not being an expert, I do seem to remember... Didn't they make it where the shark became increasingly more, like, malevolent and conscious and intelligent? And like, it seemed like the shark went from sort of being a predatory menace to, like, a serial killer or something, in a way.
I
like,
just remember Lou Gossett Jr. was in the 3D one.
Where he's going out to get them on purpose. Like, he's not just eating anymore. He's, like, out for revenge.
Candygram. This is... I'm only a dog.
Yeah, yeah. But the next one, I remember having this one for sure. This was right up my tiny pea-brained alley. This was something you didn't have to be mature at all to enjoy.
Well, first, there was the one that was never published, which was issue number 7. It was numbered. The next issue that was published was numbered at number 8. But Marvel Super Special number 7 in 1978 was the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was completed... Never saw the print.
I don't think I vaguely remember that movie as not being... I mean, wasn't that where, like, Peter Frampton and all these people cover?
Yeah, it was the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. It made the cover of Pizzazz, and Stan wrote a cover copy joke, if it was Stan. It just seems like his humor of one of them stepping in dog doo.
I mean, it just seemed like an odd... bending of a couple of genres that didn't need to be bent together. So I don't think we're missing anything. I mean, maybe there's some pages out there someone can clue us into, but I'm certainly not going to spend a lot of time looking for them.
All right, so give us number 8. You loved it. It was...
Number 8 is Battlestar Galactica. Not this Sci-Fi Channel nonsense, but like the original Battlestar Galactica, which for a seemingly moronic young Andy, this was the perfect fare. Like, they had these... killer robots known as Cylons. And basically they look kind of like shiny stormtroopers, but their shtick was a glowing eye, electronic eye that went back and forth.
Yep.
So they had these visor kind of centurion style helmets with no mouths and no ears and no nose, which made them particularly menacing. I just thought it was a great design. I mean, not practical in any way because the actors are wearing these bulky outfits and you're like, that wouldn't work, but as a young kid, it completely captured my imagination, and this was perfect, the sort of supplementary material that you would get, because as a little kid, I got to watch a lot of TV, but it wasn't like I could choose sometimes. So sometimes you'd just be watching whatever the family was watching, so I wouldn't always necessarily get to see Battlestar Galactica, because if it conflicted, again, this is in the age before you could arrange your TV schedule via internet, TiVo, VCR, whatever. So if my parents wanted to watch something and it was conflicting with what I wanted to watch, we were generally watching what they wanted to watch.
By your command.
So, yeah. So, and then this one is, we've got Roger McKenzie and then Ernie Colon on art. And I think it's really tremendous. Like, it looks just like... all these cats.
It really is good. It's good Ernie Colon. I mean, this is like his Euro style. It looks like almost like Barbarella, you know, art. It's really, really fine.
And the ship design was kind of fun. Like the ships for the good guys from Earth are not entirely dissimilar to like X-Wings, but they're... Right. Not so close. And then the bad guys have these kind of disc-shaped ships.
Yep.
And he also captures the sunburst. Because the armor was so polished on those crappy old TV cameras, it would really catch the shine off them. And so they put those little starbursts in everywhere. But it's really just a fun tale of, like, it's Earth is kind of down to, like, this last kind of arc. And they're trying to find a homeworld, and the robots have taken over. And so basically the Starbuck and the army guys are the military support. So it's almost like you have a floating ark, and then you have the little defending ships, and they're always on the run. And I thought that was a pretty clever, like, it's an old-timey trope from TV, you know.
And remember,
the Hulk was on the run, right. The Kung Fu was on, like, it was a good way to, like, just keep
a chase scene. Moving. Who doesn't love a good chase scene?
Yeah.
You know, and it was even one step deeper than that, Andrews. It was, they were former colony from Earth that were colonized way deep in space, and that planet went to crap. So they had to get on the space arcs. And what they're doing is they're looking for Earth. They're looking for the mother planet back again where they kind of came from. And it's like their Shangri-La that they're kind of looking for. Because then they came out with that series like Galactica 1985 or whatever when they actually found Earth and arrived. But anyway.
But the art here allows for a few action sequences. Like the Cylon trooper has this sword and does in this guy. And that would not have flown on TV. Again, they were taking advantage of the comic book media when you couldn't really, you know, there's no way you could show that on TV. And even if you could, the way those creatures moved and the awkwardness of it, it wouldn't have visually come off anyways. Not that, like I said, they wouldn't have from a standards and practices viewpoint. But I just think that this is fun. Like, I don't know, if you're like a new Battlestar Galactica fan, I wonder how you'd think if you think this is cheesy and old, but I enjoyed it. And I also had some of the toys as a kid.
Me too.
It never reached like Star Trek, Star Wars, no, toy penetration.
Well, the legend was, I don't know if it was true, but back in the day, I thought they were stopped making them because those little bullets that came out of the Cylon ship opened, the wings kind of popped out of the disc and shot these little bullets. And I think that they were considered dangerous or whatever, or someone swallowed them or whatever, and they were pulled.
Oh, the good old days. Poorly made toys that hurt people.
Yes.
And as usual, this is still at the time when they're peppering this with articles. So they have Tom Rogers writes a little piece about the thing. And like I said, it's giving you that sort of exposure to the property. Not just here's a comic book story, but also a few extras that we were also hungry for because we just didn't get it. And also, my folks were all right with comics, but comics were a much better deal than those magazines deal. Like, you could get a comic a lot. I mean, this was obviously a more expensive than a comic, don't get me wrong. But you know what I mean? Like, if I wanted to experience something, I could buy a bunch of comics, or I could get one, you know, $3.95 magazine, which isn't going to last me as long as getting, you know, like, 8 comics or whatever. And as a kid, back then, at least, I was always kind of ruthlessly calculating how far your money could go.
And these were expensive. Even the Marvel Super Specials were expensive compared to regular comics. During the time from 77 to 86, regular comics were like 30 cents to 60 cents. And then, you know, in that they climbed that range, and Marvel Super Special started at $1.50 and ended at $2.50. So that is quite inflated. Also, I want to say about this Battlestar Galactica is it had a Bob Larkin wraparound cover that was beautiful. And had pinups. There's 2 Dave Cockrum pinups, including 1 Cylon pinup by Cockrum. That's awesome, that I'll post. A Rick Bryant pinup, a Howard Bender pinup, and a Bruce Patterson pinup, too.
And really nice pinups, too. Some of those, I know we talk a lot about the Marvel Masterwork ones, and some of those pinups in there are just really hacked out stuff. I was reading the Daredevil Volume 3 Masterworks one, and they have a Daredevil pinup in that looks like what Liefeld did to Captain America. They did the Daredevil in this pinup, and it's like, wow, but these are top. But while $1.50 was expensive, it was still cheaper than a lot of the magazines. The other, you know, if you were comparing it to
the Starlog stuff.
Remember that Starlog or whatever, you know, it was a cheaper deal.
This Battlestar Galactica one was also unique in that it came out as a tabloid size and as a magazine size simultaneously. And it kicked off a series. They had a very short-lived regular comic book series of Galactica after this. Issue number 9 of Marvel Super Special in the beginning of 1979 was another Savage Sword of Conan in color. Roy Thomas, the usual conspirators, John Buscema, Howard Chaykin, and Tony DeZuniga.
And one element I loved about this, which people probably hate, I love the arrows directing the panel flow when it's slightly unusual. Even today, sometimes I'll read panels out of order or something. I mean, I can see that bothering people, but I really liked it. It clearly lets you know the flow. And they're not, you know, giant. They're just little red arrows pointing, you know, this panel to that panel type of thing.
My favorite thing about this issue is there's a painted John Buscema cover. You don't get to see too many full color paintings by Buscema. And here you have one. In fact, the very first time I put oil paint to canvas was trying to recreate the Conan pose here on this cover.
Oh, nice. How did that, do we still have that? That's what you need to be throwing
My
up
grandfather
on.
helped me a lot. Had to help me a lot to help me learn how to work that medium. But I don't know. I don't know if that's anywhere.
There's another tale of Conan. He's roving around looking for treasure. And as usual, it's the same, like all his compatriots betray him. But he lives up to his code and hands-on and ends up dealing with some devilish sorcery, an old god that requires a sacrifice. And Conan somehow manages to do in the god, but walks away with nothing.
Trail of the Bloodstained God, and it is an adaptation of a R.E.H. Robert E. Howard unfinished story that Elsberg DeCamp finished. There was also a really cool chronology of Conan comic books done by Don and Maggie Thompson of CBG, which was kind of neat.
And, and both these also had the big map.
Right. Color.
Color, because I believe Howard had done that map from way back when. It floats around in some of the trade paperbacks. There's also the surprise that I had not, a voice I would not expected to hear from doing the art on another part of this book, too.
Yeah, it's Roy Thomas and Christy Marks. Christy Marks ended up doing a lot of writing for television, wrote Gem, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, G.I. Joe, but she also had a comic book for Epic under Marvel, The Sisterhood of Steel, and recently she wrote Amethyst for DC in the return of that character. They did in some sort of sorcery comic book or something like that. But Roy Thomas and Christy Marks wrote a 15-page Red Sonja story.
And more, I thought, was much more interested that it was Howard Chaykin doing the art.
That's why I let you say it.
I was like, whoa, this is coming in, because I'm trying to mentally place it. You know, I think this would have been before he did his Shadow book, but after American Flag is going on.
Oh, no. American Flag wouldn't come around for another 3 years, maybe.
Okay.
He was doing work for Conan, for the Conan office, though. He was doing some work on Savage Sword. He was doing fill-ins on the Conan the Barbarian color comic. And he was doing a lot of his funky stuff for the black and white magazines and, some of the Marvel Spotlight premiere-y kind of stuff that he was doing, you know, Dominic Fortune and all that business.
Oh, I forgot all about Dominic Fortune. Yeah, and this is fun because the coloring is done with sort of a watercolor-y style, but there's a ton of Zippitone or whatever.
I think it's terrible. I think the coloring is awful on this.
Whatever we call it nowadays. I mean, you know how much I love tone, so.
Yeah. So does Jenkins.
I eat that stuff up. But what's weird is that it's very kind of sketchy, the line work. And
yeah.
I would have been curious to see this in black and white, but it's just interesting to see like old Chaykin.
Yeah.
You know, he's a guy that, I mean, there's still elements of him that you recognize, but he's moved with the time. You know, he doesn't just crank out the same looking artwork.
Issue 10 was Star-Lord by Doug Munch, Gene Colan, and Tom Palmer under an Earl Norum cover. And this was Peter Quill going through a black hole and meeting this gargantuan ship that has all these different, like, nodes and environments and stuff. And he falls for an alien girl that he has to leave behind in the very end. I went through Star-Lord's early publishing history in Marvel Noise episode 194, if you want to check it out.
I was about to say, I seem to remember you talking about Star-Lord in this.
There's an interesting 22-page second story that's called Sleep Perchance to Die, written by Mark Day and art by Ernie Colone. And this is like an astronaut pilot having a fever dream fantasy. That was a good little tale.
I like that. I really enjoyed the cover. It's just an old pulp cover of our hero with the damsel at his feet clutching his leg. I mean, it's not going to win originality, but I thought it was very striking. And generally, I like the artwork throughout both, even though it's two different art teams. I thought it was really strong. And this almost feels like it should have come out in the late 70s. It's got that kind of trippy sci-fi where they're trying to
work their ideas
maybe a little bit harder than they should have at some point.
Yep. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. Where's my big hardcover coffee table art book of Earl Norum stuff? Come on now. Let's get that out there.
And the cologne is the second one. And I like this one too, although I will warn people there is a naked female breast exposed. So, you know, if that's going to be a problem for you.
I have it pinned up on the wall here in the bunker.
And then they end up, and again, they throw in just as Maurice Horn does an article, and he did all these encyclopedias of different comics.
Yeah, animation and science fiction.
And he does a little a timepiece. But I thought this one would have been nice because I think you could have handed this to any kind of science fiction fantasy person, and they would have been immediately at home. Yeah. I mean, I got to say, I like the second story, but it's really basically John Carter as an astronaut.
Yep.
Instead of as a Civil War dude.
Issues 11 through 13 at the very end of the 70s of Marvel Super Special were Weird World related. And Weird World was the Lord of the Rings-ish, Tolkien-esque inspired Doug Munch creation. Doug Munch and Mike Plug actually created it with Tyndall's Quest. That was in Marvel Premiere, issue number 38, a few years earlier. And I covered the Marvel Premiere series in episode 193 of Marvel Noise. How about that? But later, also, Weird World would pop up in Epic Illustrated in the early 80s. And in 1986, there was a few issues of Marvel Fanfare where Pat Broderick and Mike Plug did some Weird World stuff with Munch. But here it's three issues totaling 106 pages of The Warriors of the Shadow Realm, written by Munch with art by John Buscema and Rudy Nebrese, and then painted, like airbrush painted colors. They really experimented with how they did the coloring process with Peter Ledger was the airbrusher.
And you want a demand. I want like an oversized collection of Epic Illustrated.
Yeah, no
kidding. Together. I mean, I guess the rights would be impossible.
They don't own it. They don't own it. Yeah, it was all.
But that I mean, I guess I would take Marvel Fanfare too, but Epic would be the, like just some real big, giant. Awesome. But the paint and colors really come off nice. The story didn't land me. It kind of seems like it meanders a bit. And also, their choice of protagonists, they're like these elf things. The problem, like, I don't know, is it going to draw comparisons to ElfQuest?
It
did in my head.
It has
And
to.
ElfQuest came out a bit better because they made them more stronger personalities and more of a crew, and they also have the older guy who's kind of comedic relief a little bit, and that's always a tough line. It's tough to throw all that in, and I think they might have been better leaving that guy out. I don't know, Steve, what did you, where do you, I mean, it looks pretty.
I very quickly was just in the rhythm of just looking at the pictures and stuff, and when I was a kid, I actually didn't have these issues. I had some of the other Weird World stuff, but it was always, you know, Tolkien light.
Yeah. It doesn't have the sense of, it's really the story of these two elves or whatever the heck they're called.
Yeah, just like
as opposed to the story of the world. And that's what Tolkien has. Well, you have the story of Frodo, but it's also the story of all these different lands and the world and the whole place. But that's not to say there aren't some impressive pages in here. Like some double page spreads or single.
Oh, the art's fantastic. And like I said, the coloring was revolutionary for what they were publishing at the time.
And they end up putting like a map in as well, which I enjoyed that in those old fantasy science fiction. Sure. You'd open it up and try and pore over, even though my sense of geography isn't great, so I'd never be that awesome at placing it, but I liked having it there. But yeah, I'm sure there are fans out there, and I don't want to get the ire of them, but I can see where it didn't go. But you could tell they had high hopes, because there's a photo of, like, Stan and the whole crew in the office, and, you know, they were thinking, oh, this is going to be some, you know, we're going to get an animated movie out of it, or something. Like, it seemed like, I don't know, I hate to be cynical, but almost like it was calculated in a way, like they were putting these components together.
I think they were being cool and publishing some stuff that wasn't superhero fare.
Yes. I'm all about that.
And they spread the property around throughout different avenues of their publishing strategies. So, you know, if they were planning on doing something with it, they certainly didn't.
Well, no, I mean, I think they gave it the air. I just don't think it ended up catching. Like, I think they gave it all you could give it. And I think if it had hit... then we would have seen other stuff. But we can move to the next
one. Speaking of hitting, issue 14 is Meteor, the adaptation of the feature film, this time written by Ralph Macchio with art again by Gene Colan and Tom Palmer under an Earl Norum cover. Avalanches, tidal waves, people fleeing to the subways. I didn't see this movie.
I didn't remember it. It was not... I mean... Obviously, in hindsight now, the full-page spread of a meteor taking out the Twin Towers is a little, you know, makes you feel kind of weird in a strange way. But I got to say, the art is...
Oh, it's Colin Palmer. Yeah.
I mean, it just... it's some unrealistic... Like, they've made a point... All disaster movies are unrealistic. But now we know that any sort of thing on this... Like, the giant meteor they show would... basically wipe out all of mankind type of thing, as opposed to just trash a few buildings or whatever. But
Hey, before we move on to the next issue, I should also say about Weird World that I thought what I found the most engaging about reading those three issues was all the back matter stuff. Because like you said, there was the pinups and the posters and the sketchbooks and the creator profiles, the maps, the making of articles. But there was also like a history of fantasy and literature. Like
yes.
Text piece by Ralph Macchio. And then an even better one was several pages, The Traditions of Fantasy in American Illustration. They did like news strips, like a full page, like Little Nemo and Crazy Cat and all these different things. Really cool that Marvel would do that.
I liked it. Like I said, it reminded me in the Star-Lord one, they had that one about science fiction. Like they were really trying to make these have a ton of content for your $1.50. I felt like you probably could have walked away being like, oh yeah, not only am I getting the comic, I'm reading this stuff. And back then, the ones of these I had, I would have been reading cover to cover just for lack of other stuff to read. Even, I mean, I would have enjoyed it, but even if I didn't enjoy it, I'd just read it because that's what I had to do.
And weren't the house ads great, too, like for the other Marvel properties and mags and different things? I got a kick out of that kind of stuff. It put me right into the 70s.
Well, later on when we get to the ones for the magazine, for the subscriptions, that really...
Yeah. So now we're into the early 80s here, and we have the magazine really turning to just churning out nothing but film adaptations like four or five times a year. And issue 15 is Star Trek, the motion picture, adapted by Marv Wolfman right before he'd leave for DC, with art by Dave Cockrum and Klaus Janson under a Bob Larkin cover. Larkin and Norum were back and forth competing with each other on covers and just trying to outdo each other, and I think the Marvel magazines have some of the most beautiful covers of any magazine publishing group of the era just because of that.
Yeah, and the likenesses are spot on. I mean, they might have shaved a few pounds off of Scotty, but I don't think he'll complain.
This is the first Star Trek motion picture, V'ger. You know, getting the band back together, that whole deal.
I hated this movie so much.
I understand.
As a little kid, like, this, remember, people, this came out after Star Wars. You can't feed young children Star Wars and then expect them to sit through a no-action space movie and be like, hey, how come no one likes this thing? You know, I just saw lightsaber battles and scary Sith lords and, you know, now I get arguments about our obligation. I mean, it was clearly not for young people. I remember getting dragged to this one. And I was excited. I used to watch the show. And the show had more of a sense of things usually happened on the show. You know, they'd fight bad guys. They still had the pontificating, but there was also action segments.
Well, remember, even just the ship leaving the dry dock was like a 20-minute piece of film. It was crazy. It didn't help matters at all in this adaptation. Marie Severin's colors, for some reason, the palette, so many blue, pinks, and purples that it just read like, I don't know, like an Easter egg. I didn't care for what they did here at all. Although, hey, Dave Cockrum, although he's kind of hidden under Klaus Janson.
I actually think the colors were, I'm sure she was just trying to inject any sense of anything happening during the movie. Which the movie didn't bother to. But again, they check all kinds of extra cool interviews, and they have a little glossary of different things. I mean, I don't really think you need a force field definition. Mm-hmm. Anyone buying the Star Trek magazine? But there were certainly things, you know, like I didn't know Quad L14. Like, there was enough of it that I didn't know that it was good to have in it, but I was like, really, you're going to give me a force field definition?
You wanted lightsabers, though, Andrew?
Yes.
You got lightsabers. Issue 16 in 1980, The Empire Strikes Back. Archie Goodwin, Al Williamson, and Carlos Garzon. Yes, Williamson, Garzon, Star Wars. Perfect. Under a Bob Larkin cover. Who else?
And I read the crap out of them old Star Wars comics, because I started with the first movie, and I went right through. Some of you may remember before people were kind enough to give me pieces of art for my different avatars. I was using Jackson from, you know, Star Wars, probably number 8 or 9 or whatever. The giant non-rabbit, rabbit-looking alien. And this is right. I mean, boy, you couldn't. I don't know who you'd. Maybe it might be sentimentality, but I don't know what artist you'd put on this that could do a better job.
No, Al Williamson is the Star Wars artist for sure. There's a nice Luke pinup, a Vader pinup, and a great pinup of the Imperial AT-AT Walker in the back. I also noticed, we see her name on a lot of stuff. Glynis Ween did the colors, but Rick Veitch did the letters. How about that?
Yeah, and they look, you know, this is back before you just plugged the font in and typed it all out.
Issue 17 in 1980 was a photo cover because the movie was Xanadu. And this was covered by J.M. DeMatteis with layouts by Rich Buckler and Jimmy Janes and finished pencils by Mike Nasser, Brent Anderson, and then inks by Al Milgram, Bill Sienkiewicz, and Joe Brozowski. Are you kidding me? On Xanadu?
This one was a bit of a head scratcher. I mean, I remember I didn't see this in the theater, but I've seen it on HBO, and it seems like, who is going to be rushing out to buy the comic book version?
Yeah, this doesn't translate to the comics very well at all.
This thing.
People hate this movie, but I actually found it pretty charming. Olivia and the Electric Light Orchestra there did the music all together and had that Have to Believe It's Magic song and a couple other things that weren't bad. She danced with
Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly, right. You know, there were some things that were charming about it, but it was definitely the disco roller derby era. I don't think it deserves the rap it got, but it certainly didn't deserve to be a comic either.
I'm sure they ate it, too, because who was buying? I can't
but
imagine.
Mike Nasser, Brent Anderson, thing. Bill Sienkiewicz, are you kidding? Like Rich Buckler? What the heck? All right. Issue 18, 1981, it's the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Walter Simonson wrote it, John Buscema drew it, with Klaus Janson inks, and a Howard Chaykin cover.
My older brother went to college for archaeology. Like, we were Indiana Jones fanatics, and I believe he's the one that brought me to Star Wars when I was a little kid, too, because I would have been too little to go on my own. And so we were Indiana Jones nuts. Like, he loved it. I loved it. This was just a fun movie, a super faithful adaptation. I mean, the art is as you would expect. I think the art's good, but, you know, if you have a criticism, it would be the same criticisms you've had over this art team for other stuff, too. I mean, maybe, you know, they don't go crazy on the detail, but this is about, you know, recognizing the characters and moving the story along. All of which they do. Like, this is not going to be one where you're caught up in double-page spreads every other one, you know?
Yeah, I saw this on a sneak preview, actually, before it actually opened as part of a birthday party thing. And, yeah, return to the serialized, fast-paced action, boom, boom, boom. Very comic book-like movie and very movie-like comic book adaptation.
Yeah, I really, that Indiana Jones was one of those movies I went nuts for as a kid. I was like, this is a movie. I mean, it's funny because obviously in hindsight now I recognize how he was lifting from the older serials in a way, but, you know, I wasn't watching a bunch of weird black and white serials, so for me it was all new. But then Star Wars lifts those, you know, the X-Wing fight, the space fights are all just dog fights from the earlier movies as well, but it's new. Like every comic is somebody's first, every movie is someone's first.
Issue 19 in 1981 was 007, James Bond, For Your Eyes Only, adapted by Larry Hama with art by Howard Schenken and inks by Vinnie Coletta. Howard Schenken cover. This has got the alpine ski chase and the rock climbing infiltration of the mountainous fort and all that business, with 16 pages of behind the scenes and set pictures and stuff like that. Definitely becoming more of a movie magazine.
And people may hate it, but Roger Moore was my James Bond. That's the one I saw in the movie theater. I think For Your Eyes Only might have been the first James Bond movie I saw.
Really?
But I was, yeah. Because I saw one or two of them.
Not Moonraker?
In the theater. No, I don't think I saw Moonraker
Not
in the theater.
Spy Who Loved Me? That was the first one I saw in the theater.
No, but like I said, we didn't get to go that often. If it wasn't the big theater, we go once in a while. We go into the drive-in once in a while, too. But those were usually kind of junkier movies.
Issue number 20 was Dragon Slayer, adapted by Denny O'Neill with art by Marie Severin and John Tartaglione under an Earl Norum three-panel cover that was beautiful.
Now, this is the one that I actually read the comic way before I ever read.
Same here.
I didn't see this till, you know, years after it had come out. I think it, and they might have mentioned this in there, but it sort of had a weird line about kind of not being for being for kids, but being a little edgy too. I seem to remember, wasn't there some like partial nudity, and it was a little more violent than an average one. So it kind of went that weird line of not being super violent and adult, but not being super kid friendly either. But I thought this adaptation works. You know, it's got that tons of as opposed to the Indiana Jones, there's a lot more cross hatching and detail in the artwork.
Issue 21 was Conan the Barbarian, but not another Savage Sword type tale. This was an adaptation of the Conan the Barbarian movie, the first one, adapted here by Michael Fleischer and John Buscema. Who else? It included 10 pages of making of interview with John Milius and Arnold and James Earl Jones and stuff. I thought the colors here were exceptionally good compared to some of the other issues, and then looked and noticed there were two colorists, one of them being Lynn Varley, Frank Miller's wife.
What I really liked about this is we get our Conan. They don't try and make him look like Arnold at all.
No, it's John Buscema.
So I'm like, yes. I didn't need, like, an Arnold Conan. Our Conan. But, yeah, the colors have kind of a very soft feel to them, and they're a bit more imposing than in the previous Conan ones.
Issue number 22 in 1982 was Blade Runner by Archie Goodwin, Al Williamson, and Carlos Garzon, and Dan Green under a Jim Steranko cover, Andrew.
I remember this movie was a crazy movie. I remember being like, whoa, this is before I was aware of, I didn't come to Philip K. Dick's actual work till much later, but I remember this was just this crazy movie that I was like, whoa, this is the future. Because it was one of the early times when we saw a science fiction world that was kind of grimy and gritty. And, you know, this was, but it also had, you know, poor people and rich people. It was just our world advanced however long, and the likenesses. Williamson really is the king of capturing these characters.
What I felt was it was like Tokyo exploded on the whole world. You know what I mean? It was like, I really felt like it was specifically trying to do like Japan amped up to the nth degree. The streets, the gothicness of it all, and really cool. I enjoyed the story, obviously, as a lot in our generation did, and the adaptation, having it be Williamson and Garzon, not to leave out Green, really good.
Yeah, if you enjoyed the movie, or even if you were intrigued, I would say this is something you'd be well suited to do.
And they did the credits in the back for the cast and the creative team, and then a 12-page photo album from the movie, too.
Yeah, they just put everything. These were, now I don't know that they'd be needed with the media being so. A movie comes out now, it'll be released DVD by
the. You can just watch the movie over and over again. Yeah, absolutely. Issue 23, also in 1982, was Annie, written by Tom DeFalco with art by Wynn Mortimer and inks by Vinnie Coletta. Though not right at first, you pretty much notice about 8 pages in or so, all of a sudden the Coletta inks hit. It's like, bam. But this one had a photo cover, and it had a 14-page feature on the cast and an interview with Leonard Starr, the creator of Annie, which was kind of neat. And then there was an interesting, I found, a John Huston director filmography in the back, too, that was kind of neat. I certainly found that more interesting than the primary material.
I thought they did a pretty, I remembered Carol Burnett was in the movie.
Yep.
And I could recognize her. Like, I haven't seen that movie in,
there's a reason for that.
A long time. I remember catching on HBO or something. That was another one I didn't see in the theater, but I would have seen it. And I do like how they make the credits, and a lot of these end up looking like movie credits for the comic, too, which is fun. But we got to get to the next one is really something.
Issue 24, which was The Dark Crystal. David Anthony Kraft did the adaptation along with Brett Blevins and Vinnie Coletta.
I am a huge Brett Blevins fan from his New Mutant stuff.
Yeah, I loved his painted cover here. Ooh.
And there's kind of like a whole painted style. And this is something that could come out today.
Yeah.
And I think everybody would gobble. Like, there's nothing dated, I feel, about the art. Or the presentation. I guess maybe the lettering.
Those faces on those guys. I mean, it's a little Fraggle Rocky, those faces. But this is that Jim Henson kind of dark fantasy. A great, great tale. The costuming and stuff was outrageous. The puppetry work was.
It was. Although, to be fair, I don't know the last time you've seen it, but it is kind of Fraggle Rocky.
I didn't use that term.
I thought you were referring to the artwork more than
the artwork definitely. No, I'm talking about the faces of the puppets themselves.
I was talking about this comic.
The comic is definitely moderny. And also, for Coletta inks, they're pretty soft, right? I mean, he did a nice job on a lot of it, and I'm actually wondering if Blevins did like a bulk of the inks maybe, or the inks on a lot of the figures, and Coletta came in, and because I also see where he did some of the, some of the lines are indicative of him, but other spots it looks a little bit more like that Blevins brush that I'm used to.
Also, the pacing on this movie wouldn't fly today. It's very deliberate.
Yeah.
And it would be totally booted. Like, no one's gonna let the kind of shots linger and the time spent. But really, I mean, it's fun to think that the Dark Crystal is still, all those Henson material is still being generated out. I think Boom has the license for those. And they're still doing work with these different worlds. But I was really impressed with this. I like the movie a lot. I have fond memories of it. I even watched that Jim Henson reality show about making Creature Shop one. Again, they have the pictures from the movie stills where you can see the little elfin creature.
Yeah, it's like 12 pages of that in the back.
And that's the type of stuff that we all gobbled up. And the other thing I liked is they didn't kind of break the fourth wall, which now I don't mind, but back then I kind of bothered. Like, you don't see, like, the puppeteers and stuff like you would in some of the features. You know what I mean? Where they do the half cutaway and it's, you can see the guy underneath or whatever. Like, here it's just all the puppets as a real world. And that's what it was to me. The Dark Crystal comic and book, big thumbs up for me.
In the beginning of 1983, Marvel Super Special number 25 was the only one to come out in comic size only. It never came out in magazine size. And this was written by Bill Mantlo and Bob Budiansky and Clive Smith. And the material was, the art was all cells from the movie because it was an animated movie. And that is Rock and Rule.
And when looking at this, at the time, I don't remember the movie. It somehow skipped my consciousness at the time. I remember it afterwards, but I was thinking, what's the point of a comic book adaptation of an anime? Like, it really does feel like this is pretty unnecessary. I mean, I guess if you can't, this really does feel like it's not adding anything to the mix except, you know, this would be your only way to live in that world again. But I wish they could have done something. I mean, they put in some material about who the different animated characters, what rock stars they're based on, but it really felt like you weren't getting much out of it.
Issue number 26 in 1983 also was Octopussy, and this was covered by Steve Moore with art by Paul Neary. Really fine work by Paul Neary, too. Not like the Paul Neary that came around and took over Captain America from Mike Zeck.
No, this is super detailed work, Roger Moore, and the cover. Yeah, I thought you'd mention is a very nice, that kind of like painted over.
Who is it, though? Picture. Is it Norum? Is it Larkin? I can't tell.
I can't tell either, and I'm not sure how they, I don't remember the movie well enough to know if that was like also
the movie poster.
The movie poster, maybe.
That might be.
But that's why I'm like, I wonder if, because it looks a little too nice. No, I mean, this is before Alex Ross had made painted covers so popular, but it does look pretty fancy for this sort of comic. But the artwork's super detailed. Maybe I thought a little heavy-handed with the colors.
Sure.
But, you know, what are you going to do? There's
a lot of these issues are. You know, I think a lot of them are because they were able to be color and they were trying to do a lot with the few techniques they had available to them, you know.
But again, this is Roger Moore, James Bond, so those of you that don't like that, steer clear. But I was always, you know, he seemed like a snooty British dude, and that's my James Bond, rather than a scrappy Scotsman.
13 pages in the back with a lot of black and white pics from this movie, but there's a Bond essay that covers his history. That's pretty cool.
And a nice, you know, I like the pinup photos. And an ad for Epic Illustrated. Woohoo!
Issue 27 in 1983. Now we're to the Return of the Jedi. Archie Goodwin, yeah. Al Williamson and Ron Frenz, Carlos Garzon and Tom Palmer under a Bill Sienkiewicz cover.
And now these, I had the American ones also on one of my trips to Ireland, I did buy the English versions in their sort of weird oversized format where they'd split the issues differently. That was fun. I don't know, something about seeing it this way makes some of the more offensive parts less offensive. Yes, I'm talking about the closing scene on Endor. I mean, I still like Return of the Jedi. I was a young person. Or young enough, and Star Wars always held a high place. But I think they do a great job of making the Ewoks look more fierce than maybe the outfits came across red on screen.
Agreed.
And their movements could be, you know, no matter how you do it, you know, people in costumes don't know, especially if they're not built slim, just can't move the same way you can move in a comic book panel.
You want some more Brett Blevins?
Yes, please.
David Michelinie and Brett Blevins and Vinnie Coletta, at least on the last chunk of pages, did Crawl.
And I had this one too. I remember this I remember that magazine cover. I went and saw this in the theater.
Ditto.
I had this magazine, and I'm sure I must have nagged someone to see it. Because looking at it now, I'm sure all my parents or whoever would have been like, ugh, all right, if we have to. But what I liked about it for me was, and maybe I'm wrong, but I remember this being a completely original property.
Yeah, with that cool throwing star weapon thing.
And what I really liked were the Cyclopses, who made that terrible deal to see the future, but all they can see is their own death right before it happens. Right. And I thought that was such a clever, I remember that to this day. And the bad guy, again, sort of stealing from the Battlestar Galactica, no faces. Like, there's always something creepy about when you're fighting people that don't have, that are humanoid but don't have human features. The only thing I thought that didn't translate as well is actually the final end boss looks more impressive in real life than in the comic, which is rare. Normally, I think the comic does a better job, but they put pictures in the back. And, like, he's got this weird sort of opening in his chest and everything. And it's just creepy as all get out. It's right out of Alien and the red bloodshot eyes and the red mouth. And I just thought it didn't translate as well. But the likenesses I thought were good. I mean, I don't know these actors. So, to me, they were, for all I know, they were, you know, well-regarded classical Shakespearean or whatever. But as a kid, you know, this was Crawlin' His Lady.
Pretty good Tarzan tale in issue 29, which adapted Tarzan of the Apes. And this was written by Sharman Devano and Mark Evanier, with art by Dan Spiegel. And nice colors, I thought, and looked and saw the name was by Will Migniot's wife, Joe Migniot. So another Evanier conspirator, as Dan Spiegel is. Really lifelike covers and a frontispiece by an artist named Charles Wren. And this was a much more traditional adaptation of ERB's Tarzan.
Yeah, this is going to strike some people as a terrible thing to say. Never was a huge Tarzan guy. I remember the animated cartoon, I think it was from Filmation, that was like paired with Batman.
Yep.
And I don't know, I think the corny yell he does and beating on his chest was just a big turnoff for me. But I will agree with you, this is well done, particularly the animals. Animals are always a crapshoot in comics.
If you ever want to read a good Tarzan-type primer, and I would recommend that you do sometime, because I even think they might be out there free on the web, on the Kindle thing or something. It's Tarzan Jungle Tales by ERB, and it's all short stories. And it's kind of Tarzan first acclimating himself to his world. And there's some crazy short stories in there. One where he kind of like falls in love with a woman ape. And they're like, you know, you can't be marry an ape, they're telling him, you know. And another one where he kind of teaches himself how to read. And there's a lot of kind of Tarzan the scientist in there. And that he's a pretty smart dude. And a lot of really good descriptive stuff. Tarzan the Jungle Tales is my favorite of the Tarzan books, just for that reason. But anyway,
maybe I'll have to check it out. Maybe that'll be what triggers the Tarzan gene in me, but I don't know, it's just jungle adventure. But there was very few of the jungle genre, like, I don't know, taming lions and stuff, just didn't seem to be my what got me going. I was more a space adventurer, or maybe some archaeological adventures.
Like in issue number 30 in 1984, it's the sequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, adapted by David Michelinie, with art by Butch Geis, and pretty heavy inks by Aiken and Garvey, but a little bit of a touch of Bob Camp in there, too, somewhere.
And this one, obviously, I had, although, for some reason, like, I enjoyed Temple of Doom well enough, it didn't capture me the way Raiders of the Lost Ark did, though. It was probably me, obviously, you know, at that age, between the distance between the two, I would have changed a lot. But I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like the mania I had for the first one.
Some scary moments in that movie, though, that's for sure.
Yeah, the thuggy cult, although the melting faces on the Nazis was pretty scary.
Yeah. How about the pulling out of the heart thing, though, all that? 1984 also gave us issue number 31, The Last Starfighter, under a Butch Geis cover. This was written by Bill Mantlo, with art by Blevins, and inks by Tony Salmons. Very 80s story, if I remember correctly, where there's a kind of got kid who's good at playing video games, is kind of hauled away to fight for the galaxy against lizard types.
Yes, the whole point was the video game was really a test.
Ah.
And he's a... Again, I think that, first of all, the likenesses, I don't remember the actor's name, but this looks like him in a lot of these panels. But again, I think the storyline of guy out, he's in this trailer park in the middle of nowhere, and this video game inadvertently ends up being his ticket out of that one horse dump was something I could relate to. Mind you, except I didn't have a video game or a wise old Jedi master to rescue me out of my one horse dump. Yeah. But, you know, so that storyline was an immediate hit. like the Rube, really the Rube from Way Out, has to be the hero. You know, he's basically Luke Skywalker, but Luke Skywalker is you and me. I remember enjoying the movie a lot. I think it has a bit of a cult thing, but it was strange that it never went anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, it was its own thing, and, you know, there wasn't, at least I don't remember any TV show or sequels or anything like that.
Unlike the next one, issue number 32 is The Muppets Take Manhattan, written by Stan Kay with art by Dean Yeagle and Jacqueline Rocher.
Always good to see Dean at all the, he does the convention circuit if you're of a mind to do that. Oh, and this was really odd because they really went super cartoony, which I liked, but they kind of abandoned any of the human likenesses.
Yeah.
Which I was fine with.
It's totally like a Gold Key, like Warner Brothers comic from, you know what I mean? From the 60s or something, or a Disney comic. It is really indicative of that animated comic style.
Yeah, I mean, you could see this might have been a boom Muppet comic from 10 years ago, you know?
Right.
It's funny, I hadn't seen this movie in forever, but going through this, it reminded me how the new movie really is super similar to this one. I don't know if you watched any of the new Muppet.
Haven't seen it.
Yeah, I liked them. I think I liked the second one maybe was a little bit more fun than the first one, just because it felt like a lot of the first one was a bit of resetting the table. But, I mean, it'll never match, you know, your youth or whatever. But I think these two new movies, hopefully they find an audience and kids get into Muppets, because it's pretty tough for them to compete, I think, with animated fare.
Issue 33 in 1984 is a cult classic for sure, and it's Buckaroo Banzai, with adaptation done by Bill Mantlo with art by Mark Texeira and Armando Gill.
And I really like this movie, although I don't remember anything about it, except I remember I liked it. And I remember, like, Peter Weller was kind of an interesting cat. This would have been, I'm pretty sure this is before RoboCop, so this would have been my first Peter Weller experience. And it's a Mark Texeira, Armando Gill. Oh, wait, did you give the credits?
Yep.
Sorry about that.
But I was. That's notable, though. It's Mark Texeira and Armando Gill. Mark Texeira in 1984. It's interesting.
I was a bit hypnotized by the completely bizarre lettering on the first page. It's like, looks horrible. I guess they wanted to look like it was from a dossier. But Buckaroo Banzai, again, another property that I think just didn't hit. But like you say, wasn't it a cult classic?
Sure was and is.
So it's out there, people.
And there's a lot of interview director on the set pictures and stuff like that in the back as well. As is in this next issue, which I very much enjoyed seeing some of the on-set pictures, because it's Sheena for issue number 34, adapted by Carrie Burkett and Gray Morrow. Actually shot directly from Gray Morrow's pencils, which looks pretty good, except a little too much Zipitone here and there. The pictures in the back with the profiles and stuff, it's, you know, seeing Tanya Roberts in her prime. Evolution has rarely looked so good.
Yes, Sheena of the Jungle. When this one came to HBO, young Andy would always make a point to catch this one on it. And I imagine even old Andy now would make a point to catch this one. Tanya Roberts really made an impression on me. And it's a type of impression that lasts a young man.
She was in Beastmaster too, remember?
To his dotage. Yeah, but there's a scene in when they first find her in the jungle. She's bathing or something like that.
In Beastmaster or in this one?
In this one.
Okay.
Which got it its PG-13. I mean, now the idea of seems a little...
She bathed. There's a big making of feature in the back with a Tanya Roberts profile, an interview with the producers, and an interview with the animal trainers, which is kind of funny.
And I don't know if you noticed, the one still seems a little... still. They do a live-action shot of her that seems perhaps a little... Not like so. She might need a slight costume adjustment.
In 1984, at the end of it, we got Conan the Destroyer, the sequel to the first Conan film, here adapted by Michael Fleischer and John Buscema again. And this is the one with, you know, the Grace Jones Amazon character and the Bombada, the, you know, Will Chamberlain there.
Yeah, and I remember thinking this film was fun.
It was fun. Written by Roy Thomas, actually.
I can see how people would be like, it is preposterous. But the movie had kind of went in a certain direction. And I think they kind of had to keep going that way. You couldn't show the full range of what Conan was. You know, he's a thief, a pirate, a fighter, a king. Like, all they kind of picked the sort of big, dumb, muscly guy.
And remember, the first movie was an R-rated, and this one was PG. So this one, I mean, my friends and I, we were 14 at the time. Yeah. I saw this one in the movie probably six times.
And so there was, they went that direction, which honored a part of Conan, but I think what people probably object to is it's only that one aspect of him.
Right.
Which is such a limited. So your only knowledge of that is the movies. I would say there's more to Conan out there than what's demonstrated in the movies, but that is true to a sense. But yeah, all the crazy back features with Grace Jones and Olivia Dabo. Didn't she end up now doing some voice work in some of the Marvel animated
yes.
stuff? So
yep.
It's funny, she's looped around full circle in a sense.
The next year, 1985, brought us another cult classic, Frank Herbert's Dune, adapted by Ralph Macchio and Bill Sienkiewicz, which made it even wackier, right?
I think this has, like, some really great artwork. He really, because he's being faithful to the representations of the characters, it reins him in a lot more than at his most experimental, but he still is allowing the sort of fun storytelling techniques, especially with when they're doing their special effects type shots. So I think it's a beautiful blend of someone who can faithfully render what people look like with these fantastic shots. I think it makes the comic book, to my recollection, probably more entertaining than the movie.
Ditto.
And that's all on, I mean, I guess I should also give credit to the writer in there, but I'm going to lay it at the feet of Sienkiewicz is the guy that did the heavy lifting on this, and if I'm wrong...
And John Lithgow for looking so crazy.
It won't be the first time that I've been wrong.
Issue 37 was one of my favorite science fiction books, actually, that I had read as a youth, and that is Arthur C. Clarke's 2010. And this one was adapted by J.M. DeMatteis. And the layouts were by Joe Barney and Larry Hama, but the finishes, inks, colors, cover, you name it, was done by Tom Palmer.
And this is your more Roy Scheidery Roy Scheider than the Jaws one. They really keep it on model. Steve, I'm going to have to say I did not like 2010, the movie.
Whoa, all right, the movie, but what about the story? I mean,
the story was all... The problem was, in college, I became somewhat obsessed with 2001, the movie, in an unhealthy fashion.
Okay.
And 2010 has so nothing to do with...
What?
Like, as a movie, it's such a failure.
Oh, please.
In regard to the sense of scope that I just...
It's more of the answer of things, and to get to the next... You know, it wasn't so much choreography of music and motion as the first movie was, which was... Very unusually, the movie was made at the exact same time in conjunction with as the book was being made. And they were playing off each other. That's crazy.
I think the 2001 book is not... It's one of the only examples where the movie is better than the book.
Well, this novel is a fantastic novel, 2010. Because this one, this is when Europa gets made. They go and they figure out that Europa has life on it, and they get into all of that stuff. And I just like I guess would be the whole trilogy, because it just touches upon so much cool Jupiter stuff that I like about outer space, that like Jupiter has, you know, the theory that it has a diamond center, you know, or a mountainous giant diamond center, and therefore, like, you know, chunks of it could be on Europa, and that Europa has the inner core that is warm enough that there could be life there and all that sort of business. And the whole thing of at the end, all of the, you know, moons of Jupiter being made into its own solar system of habitable planets that you can now colonize and stuff. I just thought it was great science fiction. I love Arthur C. Clarke stuff.
I enjoy Arthur C. Clarke, but I'm of a mixed... Some of it I like and some of it I didn't. Like I said, I was way too obsessed with 2001 as an experience. And in part of what I enjoyed was not having the questions answered. you know, in some ways I enjoyed the just thinking about the questions myself. But now we've broken down into film talk.
My God, it's full of stars, Andy.
We need to rope back around to some other quality movie adaptations.
Well, not so much for the last four, but let's bring it home anyway. In 1985, we got issue number 38, which was the Red Sonja movie adaptation, adapted by Louise Simonson with art by Mary Wilshire, who was a great Red Sonja artist. She did some of her regular issues, but inks by Vinnie Coletta. There was a Larry Hama pinup, though, a Bob Layton pinup, an Al Milgram pinup, and I think it's a Mary Wilshire Bill Sienkiewicz pinup on the last page that is uncredited. But, you know, this was a pretty cruddy movie and a pretty cruddy adaptation of Sonja. But the pinups are cool.
The pinups make you wish that you're like, why can't the rest of the book? These look so good in the book. And I'm with you. I remember seeing the movie, but I don't remember anything about it.
Yep.
I literally remember nothing, so that can't speak well of it, right? I mean,
and then they got the character to be Conan, but it wasn't Conan, and then they even got Arnold to play him, and it was just weird. It was the first time that the Sonja Conan properties had been broken up, right? So then you can't reference the other, and it's just crazy. It's just such a silly thing because Red Sonja was created by Roy Thomas. You know what I mean? Let's face it, Sonja is not really a REH character.
Well, so, I mean, there's a few stories here and there.
No, she's a buccaneer like lady, yeah, in one story, and she's nothing like she was, and she wasn't living in Conan's time or any of that.
No, that I remember, but I thought she did have the rule about you had to best her in combat. I thought that was still from the
I'm still trying after all these years, Andrew. Issue number 39 in 1985 was Santa Claus the movie, a Tom Palmer cover, and written by Sid Jacobson with art by Frank Springer. And really, I thought the neatest thing about this was the colors by a woman named Petra Scottis. She really took her time, and with all of the Santa's Workshop business and all the toys.
Ridiculous. I think the art team did good. I mean,
she colored a lot of that. Nice. It could have been really horribly done.
Yes, but I think the art team did good. Just these Santa's Workshop scenes are just preposterous. They're loaded with, like, toys and, like, a million elves and all this stuff. And I'm like, that's a lot of work in the old. Like, no one's dropping this out of the computer. You know, they're drawing every one of them lines.
And this is the end of Frank Springer's career here. I mean, this is after Dazzler time even, you know?
One of them yo-yos and everything. So I was just impressed at the amount of work. I mean, Santa Claus the movie, I don't remember it at all.
No.
But I was like, this is a comic where somebody, especially coming right after the Red Sonja, like where the art team was, well, Vinnie Coletta's not going to, he'd take care of Santa's Workshop.
Yeah, really.
There'd be one toy in the middle of it. But
and we've seen him destroy Frank Springer's pencils on Dazzler, Coletta, so. Issue 40 was in the beginning of 1986, and it was another Jim Henson property, Labyrinth. And this was
the
David Bowie one. Sid Jacobson again adapted it with the breakdowns by John Buscema and faithful inks over those breakdowns by Romeo Tangle.
This is where my entirely age-appropriate crush on Jennifer Connelly started and continues to this day.
Not Rocketeer?
Yeah, no, this was the movie for me, because I saw this at, when was this, 86-ish, yep, something like that. Yep. So I'm young Andy, turning to a teenager, and here's this sad young girl, you know, stuck with her brat kid, and goes off to a Jim Henson world that I want to go off to, not stuck in my boring real life. And I thought
stuck
the integration
in a world you never made.
The integration of people and puppets in this movie is pretty well done.
Yes.
It's probably hideously dated now, but at the time, man, it was pretty seamless. I mean, there's a lot, like, it's basically her and David Bowie, and that's it for 90% of the people in this thing. And the rest are just different marionettes, puppets, people in outfits, etc. But I don't know if it'll, like, you show a kid today, he might be like, bah, lame. But I liked it. And I thought the adaptation was faithful. The recognition are there, but it just doesn't, like, this is something where I don't know what I'd want in the adaptation. You know what I mean? Like, how would I?
Yes.
What would it give me? Like, some of these other ones have given me things I don't know what I could expect. But it's not a fault against it.
Even worse off with the last issue, number 41, in 1986, was an adaptation of the Howard the Duck movie, adapted here by Danny Fingeroff and art by Kyle Baker. But again here, what is this going to give you if you're already a Marvelite and have read Steve Gerber's Howard the Duck prior?
I remember seeing this in the theater and being positively depressed. I mean, real. I wasn't even the biggest Howard the Duck fan. Just this movie might have... This movie was probably the reason why I started developing a real thing against George Lucas. Like, for a man who had given me so much, like, you think he'd have an unlimited, like, he could just go on forever. But this thing was such a bad movie. And I haven't seen it since then. Maybe in hindsight, I'm older now, I'm more mature. Maybe there's some more, you know, I can read through and see the sophistication of it. But just, it's just a misstep every week. Actually, I think the comic book version at least makes Howard look better.
Yeah.
And his movement's better. So I think my recollection is this version is actually better than that horrendous movie. But maybe I'm being too hard on it. The other thing is I thought they didn't capture Beverly at all. But I also thought, who would want that role? You know, Beverly is not a great character. You know what I mean? And when they got a name actress, I'm like, no one's going to, they're going to want to make her more of a real character than the sort of fake character she is.
Not enough quack foo.
Did you see the movie or?
Not since then.
Yeah, but you were not a fan, I hope, no, or were
no,
you?
No.
I mean, feel free to defend it. Let me have it.
No, as soon as I saw what Howard looked like, I was pretty much done.
I mean, I just, even if he looked like, if they had, like I said, getting Beverly completely, because then that dynamic is all different. And then, and also Howard isn't necessarily such a nice guy. Like, it's a weird, like, how are you going to make an arguable kids movie with such an unpleasant protagonist?
Right, he's not supposed to be likable.
It just seemed like a weird, hey, it's a duck, let's do it. Besides, Beverly, we all know, is a dancer.
We'll leave Andrew scratching his head on Howard the Duck, because, let's face it, that's never going to get resolved. And that's it. We've made it through Marvel's foray into movie adaptations from the 70s and 80s. Been a long time coming. Thanks for joining me on that nostalgic journey, Andrew.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve. It's been a real fun... there's a lot of gold in them there hills.
You can bug us on Twitter at Marvel Noise, or I'm at Steve Raker. Andrew's at LA_Rabbit1. You can listen to us over on Indie Noise, which is a not safe for work podcast where we talk about anything not related to the big two. And I am going to be at the Boston Comic Con in August, from August 8th, August 10th at the Seaport World Trade Center. You can go online to see information about tickets and guest lists and all that stuff, but it's coming up, and that is going to be a good time. It was really fun last year. And, Andrew, I'm even thinking about going to Baltimore Comic Con in September 5th through 7th.
I've heard nothing but good things about Baltimore.
Need to hang out with my buddy Chris Campbell again. And actually, on that front, we might even have some Fantastic Four sites coming up at the end or the beginning of the fall. The end of the summer or beginning of the fall, with the old gang getting back together. But until then, next time I've got some more Valentino-era Guardians of the Galaxy with Jerry McDade joining me. And you can listen to the early Guardians of the Galaxy retrospective on episode 204. And the first part of the Valentino era on episode 208, Jerry joined me on both of those. And then after that, Kevin's going to join me, and we're going to do the Abnett and Lanning Guardians of the Galaxy series. You'd think there was a movie coming out or something, Andrew.
Well, people need to be right on top of it. I know they're certainly going to be doing content, and this will be a great primer. I believe in October, the new... quote unquote new Guardian series based on the old Guardians will be coming out. So everyone will be ready. We all have their pencils sharpened and be right on top of what they need to know.
Who's going to be doing Marvel history better than us? Nobody. Here's your movie prep. Here's your show prep. Right here, folks. Right on Marvel Noise.
Yeah, I don't, there is, I think we can safely say we've got the Marvel Comics angle covered.
Come back and join us next episode. But until then, enjoy a nostalgic movie or two.